Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the second episode. By the way, Wild Trekker is a series of weekly 50-minute podcasts bringing together stories, interviews, reflections, original radio plays, and adventures. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. Before things get started, I'd like to say a few words about the theme music. That's Marie Frenette singing the opening theme, with me accompanying her on the piano. And at the end of the podcast, Marie sings the same theme again, with Pascal Demeul accompanying her on the guitar. Thanks to you both. Today I would like to propose something new. I have secretly been building a new energy machine in a back room somewhere in Montreal. Now, I'm not a mad scientist with crazy white hair trying to go back in time and repair history. Not at all. I can't tell you where the energy machine is, because that would be telling, but I can bring you the sound of the machine during this podcast. I call my machine the Hyperspace Voyager. First, I have to set the parameters on my wireless keyboard, like so. Then, I have to open an airlock. Honestly, it doesn't always work properly. I keep having to go back to the drawing board. If I don't manage things very well, I might end up heading for the wrong era altogether, like going into fast forward 100,000 years in the future, rather than reverse to reach a specific date in the past. You may recall what Isaac Asimov wrote. Through hyperspace, that unimaginable region that was neither space nor time, matter nor energy, something nor nothing, one could traverse the length of the galaxy in the interval between two neighboring instants of time. That interval is where we're going in a moment. But how? Picture, if you can, my machine, a radiant, electric blue sphere of energy with gold and ice white veins of light ribboning along its outer surface. The sphere rises from the floor, floats around the room, and I can just get through the outer membrane and settle inside before activating the hyperdrive. Anyway, with my energy machine, I've chosen to go back a few decades, to January 1985, to the time when I am just beginning to learn how to write journalism for large public audiences, I've written books, translated other books, and interviewed altogether something like 15,000 people. It sounds like a lot, but you just do your research, then interview one person, then another. You may be wondering, why does anyone want to be a journalist in the first place? It's not a particularly well-paying job. The hours are long, deadlines are a daily grind, and the job brings significant risks. Well, I find journalists are often driven, disruptive outsiders. They're skeptical about traditions and disrespectful of authority. They thirst for justice and love to communicate. Their mission is to identify trends happening right now and about to happen, to dig up unknown facts, establish rigorous evidence, and right wrongs in society, to tell stories, sharing them with people just like you. Well, are you ready? Here goes. Okay, we've blown through a wormhole. It's January 1985. Wow. I don't feel the same. And my hair is still brown. Not a trace of gray or white anywhere. Listen, I'm facing a big challenge. I don't have a clue how to write a story until a BBC radio producer at the New York office in Rockefeller Center kindly offers to mentor me. I call him Colette from Montreal, and he actually spends 45 minutes explaining to me that I've written a load of crap, and the script needs a complete rewrite. Since I'm recording and mixing the story myself, then submitting it on spec, that is, without a formal contract or assurance the BBC World Service will run it, I'm allowed to incorporate the story in this podcast today. In January 1985, the founder of the Parti Québécois and Premier of Quebec, René Lévesque, acknowledges the defeat of Quebec's sovereignty and wants to remove the promotion of sovereignty as the first article of the party platform at a special congress. But this pits Lévesque, who's willing to negotiate compromises with the rest of Canada, against separatist hardliners who are determined to push for Quebec independence at any cost. The BBC is interested in having me prepare a report ahead of the Congress about how the party is likely to split into two incompatible groups. On Saturday, 19th of January, one of the most important political conventions in modern Canadian history is being held in the French-speaking province of Quebec. The nationalist Parti Québécois is gathering, under the leadership of Quebec Premier René Lévesque, to debate party strategy for the general election expected this year. In the face of a drop in public support, the party is now split over whether to keep its historic commitment to political sovereignty for the province. With a report from Montreal is George Toombs. The item follows in 5 seconds. For the last 16 years, the Parti Québécois has been a rallying point for French-speaking Quebecers frustrated by their minority status in the federal system of Canada. And the party has been an instrument in the passionate quest of these Quebecers for more political and economic power. But while the party's election to office in the province 8 years ago shocked the rest of the country, the party is now a shadow of its former self. Premier Lévesque, fearing a defeat in the coming general election, urged last November that the objective of sovereignty be dropped from the party platform.
Six of his top ministers resigned in protest, and Dr. Denis Lazure, Minister for Relations with Citizens, even gave up his seat in the assembly. He recalls the bitter moment.
So half the cabinet is divided. The other half says no. The population does not want to hear anything about sovereignty. And some weeks back, the chief, Mr. Levesque, was in between these two halves. And to our great distress, he decided to side totally with the other half. Well, we should eliminate from the discourse any talk about sovereignty.
Dr. Lazure and his pro-sovereignty colleagues have banded together in what has come to be called the orthodox wing of the party. But they can only claim about 30% of the delegates at Saturday's convention. The other 70%, variously called the pragmatist or the revisionist group, share the views of the premier and of the man many feel will eventually succeed him as party leader, the Minister of Justice and of Canadian Intergovernmental Affairs, Pierre-Marc Johnson.
I think there is a lot of grievances about the fact that we've not won on what was the basic issue we wanted to win when we founded the party in 1968. And I think that this sort of disenchantment of what is the reality of what happened in democratic society explains a lot of the fact that it hurts many people who've set 15 or 18 years of their life in that project. And we have to change because the reality has changed around us.
That change has been a hard lesson for the Parti Québécois. In office since 1976, the party has suffered a series of traumatic political defeats. A referendum to open negotiations on Quebec sovereignty was defeated. Then former Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau patriated the Constitution from Westminster to Canada without the consent of Quebec. And last autumn, Quebecers gave a massive vote of confidence in the federal system by helping elect a conservative government to Ottawa. In the face of these disappointments, the consensus, which has held the Parti Québécois together, may be breaking down. Dr. Lazure.
The common denominator for the past 15, 16 years in our political action as a party was the objective independence. If you remove that objective, then we feel, with the orthodox group, we feel that you are really committing a sort of hijacking, and you are redirecting our party to a new goal, which is no more the original goal, but the goal that we have found so often in our political history of Quebec, a sort of traditional nationalism within the context of the federal system.
Party membership, meanwhile, has declined from 300,000 8 years ago to 80,000 today. Opinion polls indicate only 20% of the electorate favors the party. And the party militants, who once terrified Quebec's Anglophones and indeed much of Canada with their commitment to Francophone nationalism, have now been worn down by years of bureaucratic drudgery. The question on many people's minds is, could the change in the Parti Québécois platform be a maneuver to stay in power? Pierre-Marc Johnson.
There's nothing bad into exercising power, and people have a tendency to oppose ideas and power. I think power is the normalcy of any political party in a democracy, unless we want to strictly become sort of an intellectual movement. There are people who believe that we should stay with our ideas and be a movement.
On the eve of the party convention, there are many unknowns. Can the premier, René Lévesque, reconcile the differences within his party? And can he win the coming general election? If the pragmatists carry the convention, when will the sovereignty issue resurface in Quebec? And what is the personal future of Mr. Lévesque, who seems to be admitting the defeat of his long-held political dream, some kind of sovereignty for Quebec. This is George Toombs in Montreal for the Outlook program.
Wow, I'm trying to give such a sense of urgency to the story. My delivery sounds like something straight out of Monty Python. If you're wondering about the intro, that's my voice as well. The BBC will replace my voice in the intro with one of their own announcers at Bush House in London. With this BBC report, I'm setting up the event, enabling something like 40 million listeners to understand what's about to happen. But it's after filing the report, when I actually attend the Parti Québécois Special Congress, that I get a sense of the dramatic dimensions of the split in the party. This division is just destroying René Lévesque, the charismatic founder of the Parti Québécois, who's long embodied the movement. Chain-smoking, stooped, with a long mop of greasy hair combed up over his bald head, he speaks with his hands in a somewhat disjointed fashion. I see suffering written all over his face as he watches the hardliners march theatrically out of the hall. He must feel they've stabbed him in the back. I'm not surprised when he falls into a deep depression shortly afterwards. In fact, we later learn René Lévesque is committed against his will to a psychiatric hospital, and he tries killing himself by jumping out of a hospital window. He officially resigns as Quebec Premier 5 months later and dies of a massive heart attack 2 years after that. Politics is such a demanding, ungrateful, tortured business. Now to April 1985, 3 months later. A story that interests me is the fate of the George River caribou herd in the far north of Quebec. Here's a clip from a documentary I do for Bayerischer Rundfunk, or Bavarian State Radio in Germany. Announcers in Munich are reading my script.
Kanadas Arktis. Das sind sturmumbrauste Winternächte, aber auch glasklare Sommertage, an denen einen die strahlende Sonne bis zum Erblinden blenden kann. Ein Land mit bedrohlichem und herrischem Charakter, in dem die Inuit, so nennen sich die Eskimos in ihrer Sprache, ihren Lebensunterhalt erbeuten müssen. Dort oben im äußersten Norden der Provinz Quebec folgen sie den wandernden Herden, wie es ihre Vorfahren seit Jahrtausenden getan haben.
That's all very well, but surely a clip from a report on the caribou I file for BBC Radio is easier for an English-speaking person to understand. Again, that's my voice doing the intro. The BBC will replace my intro with one of their own announcers in due course.
The dark winter of the Arctic is dragging on in the northern part of Quebec province in Canada. There, the wild caribou, cousins of the reindeer, have to scrape through a hard ice crust on the tundra in search of scant lichens to feed on. Exhausted by their migrations, the caribou of the George River herd are not only facing a daily struggle for survival, however, the herd has now grown so large that it may have become a danger to itself, and there are controversial plans afoot to slaughter animals each year in order to save the herd. With the report is George Toombs in Montreal. The item will follow in 5 seconds. For the caribou of the George River herd, there is no security in numbers. A report from the Quebec Provincial Department of Leisure, Fish and Game estimates the herd has grown from 3,500 head 30 years ago to 350,000 today. And while this is certainly a dramatic comeback for a herd some thought was doomed to extinction, Quebec government biologist François Goudreau says the herd is now in a state of eruption or uncontrolled growth.
Tell me why the population was so low 30 or 40 years ago, and I'll tell you what will happen if the population increase again. So what we can expect, it's the population cannot increase indefinitely. The range will be depleted by the caribou itself, or disease can occur and wash up all the herd in 2 or 3 years, depending.
Mr. Goudreau's colleague, Gilles Harvey, has been taking a hard look at ways to check the growth of the herd.
We have two tools for manage a caribou herd, the subsistence hunting and the sports hunting. And those two tools do not take enough caribou to control the erupting herd. So we have to imagine a new tools, big tools, and what we imagined was the marketing of meat.
Meat packing plants may be set up at two sites along the herd's 1,000-mile migration routes. The caribou would be rounded up and run into enclosures with the use of helicopters. Then they would be kept in the pens for up to 10 days, and between 20,000 and 50,000 head would be slaughtered each year. A huge number, but still less than the annual growth rate. Reaction from native Inuit and Indian groups is pained, hesitant, and in some cases, flatly negative. Native subsistence hunters in northern Quebec are only allowed by the province to cull about 6,000 head annually for their own uses. And moreover, the caribou has a spiritual role in some native societies. Inuit biologist Alex Gordon expresses the dilemma of his people. The singular of Inuit is Inuk.
As an Inuk, when I think about it, I would be against it, but since I feel that I'm an informed Inuk, like some people don't know the actual size, but since I feel that I know, I think it would be the only way to actually control the size of the population.
The Quebec government report on caribou harvesting on an industrial scale has drawn criticism from the international scientific community. Pat Valkenberg is a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Fairbanks and is a world authority on caribou.
If the caribou herds change their migration routes and bypass the packing plants or whatever, then you know you could be in trouble, and those plants would have to be mobile so that you could move them around, and also other things haven't been taken into account, such as increasing wolf populations. This harvestable surplus that seems to be apparent in Quebec right now may be an ephemeral thing, and it may not last very long.
Caribou are also found in Alaska. But there, once enormous herds like the 40-mile herd have been almost wiped out by overhunting and natural forces. And Alaskans would be reluctant to set up a permanent industry around the caribou resource.
The Western Arctic herd is probably the closest one to it, and it may eventually have a large harvestable surplus. But in the past, probably as partly a reaction to the recent decline of that large caribou herd, people in Alaska, both natives and non-natives, have expressed great concern that we don't allow any such commercial harvesting in the future.
Meanwhile, one recent event in Arctic Quebec may affect the project. Last autumn, a swollen northern river swept 9,600 caribou to their death. The event has traumatized native people who identify with each animal. On the other hand, Quebec government biologists interpreted the incident as a sign the herd is already being cut back by the harsh forces of nature in the Arctic. They say it would have been preferable to slaughter those caribou. For Living World, this is George Toombs in Montreal. Thank you.
After about 450 stories for the BBC, I get kind of fed up and move on to other media, such as American Public Radio, as it then was, and media in Montreal. I'm beginning to realize politics and storytelling, at least my kind of storytelling, don't sit very well together. Political journalism often comes down to polemics, the art of seizing on controversy and bashing your opponent into the ground. I find the polemical side of journalism a challenge because, by default, I'm always looking for harmony in the world, not conflict. I wonder, when we see something, are we actually creating it? What happens when we use language to describe what we see? How does that transform our perception? What if we find evidence persuasive because of our own psychological state and cultural background? Does the person gathering evidence actually get involved with the evidence he or she is collecting? Here's a clip from a Radio-Canada series on science and spirituality in French, which I own outright.
Avec cette révolution scientifique, lancée entre autres par Galilée à Padoue et ensuite à Florence, l'instrument prend sa place au centre de la recherche. Mara Mignatti est vice-directrice du Musée de l'Histoire de la Science à Florence.
Je suis très contente de vous faire connaître ce musée parce que le Musée d'Histoire de la Science de Florence préserve les instruments qui viennent de la collection de Médicis et puis de la famille de Lorraine. Il s'agit d'instruments de la Renaissance qui pouvaient être utilisés...
Here's a clip from the English version of the series for CBC Radio, which I also own outright.
St. Mark's Square in Venice. This island city was once the capital of a great trading empire and the intellectual crossroads of Europe. Here, in the Renaissance, Italians rediscovered the lost knowledge of Greek antiquity, which had been faithfully preserved over the centuries by Islamic civilization. This knowledge finally returned to Europe. Italy became the cradle of the new scientific revolution. Scientists like Galileo in the 17th century deployed mathematics and powerful new scientific instruments to observe and model the universe. Like every great trading empire, Venice had her institution of higher learning. The University of Padua was founded in 1222. Sophia Talis holds the Galileo Chair of the History of Physics at the University of Padua. When I meet her, in the courtyard of the Beau Palace, the main seat of the university, we can see a boisterous procession of students dressed up in funny costumes. They've just been awarded their doctorates.
With Galileo, observation became crucial in physics and in astronomy. It's very similar in, from a certain point of view, because Galileo experimented, and he said the only book that we must really rely upon is the book of nature, Il Libro della Natura. And he relied upon experiments and tried, of course, to give mathematical foundations to the laws that he observed or measured with his experiments. So the way that Galileo looked around him at the phenomena is completely new. I mean, he was not the first one who looked at the sky with a telescope, but he was the first one to find the important things he found. The stella nova that he observed in Padua in 1604 had been certainly observed, and its position had already been measured by others before him, but he was the first who had the courage of saying, well, this stella, this light that we see in the sky does not move with respect to the stelle fisse, to the fixed star. So it is a star, even if for the Aristotelians a star whose light was changing was unacceptable. But he measured the position, he found that it could not be something other than a star, so it was a star. For him, observation was really the only thing to rely upon.
As a result of this scientific revolution, launched partly by Galileo in Padua and subsequently in Florence, the scientific instrument takes up a central place in research. In the center of Florence, right next to the Ponte Vecchio, Carlo Triarico works at the Museum of the History of Science. The museum is just next to the Uffizi, one of the world's finest art museums. The Museum of the History of Science has the finest collection of scientific instruments I've ever seen. The collection includes the very telescope that Galileo used to observe the irregular features of the moon, as well as four tiny points of light orbiting around Jupiter. He correctly identified these points of light as Jupiter's moons. His discovery shot to pieces the traditional Aristotelian idea supported by the Church that the universe is static and contains heavenly spheres whose unblemished surfaces will never be subject to change.
This is an important piece of our museum because it's the original lens of Galileo, of the first telescope. With this telescope, Galileo was able to recognize a different universe. And it was possible in this way to change something of importance of our culture. You can look at the lens. It is a memory of our scientific research.
Now, what did Galileo use this instrument for?
Yes, we know that this lens was the original of the first important telescope by Galileo. With this instrument, Galileo was able to observe the moon, for instance, and exactly the terrestrial nature of the moon. Another thing that it was possible to recognize with the telescope was that moons, like our moon, were around Jupiter. And Galileo was able to look around Jupiter and to see the four of the moons of Jupiter.
So with this instrument, he could make out, he was the first human to do that, he could make out Callisto, Io, Europa, and Ganymede, the four largest moons of Jupiter.
Yes, the four moons, the largest of Jupiter.
Astronomy did a lot to undermine the intellectual authority that the Church once had, notably by overthrowing the traditions of Aristotelian physics, jealously guarded by the Church. As a result of his discoveries, Galileo was confined by the Inquisition for 9 years to a Tuscan villa on the outskirts of Florence. A villa shaded by umbrella pines and almond trees, a short walk from where the Arcetri Astronomical Observatory now stands. This year, in Galileo's garden, I meet a new Galileo of the 21st century, the astrophysicist Roberto Maiolino, who works at the Arcetri Observatory. Using X-ray and high-resolution radio telescopes, he discovered a celestial object farther from the Earth than any object ever observed before.
It's about 13 billion light years. That means that light takes about 13 billion years to come from that galaxy to our Earth. And also it means that we are looking at a galaxy not as it is now, but as it was 13 billion years. And also it means that we are looking at a galaxy that was emitting its life when the universe was much younger than now, about 1 billion years, that might appear a lot of time, but for cosmic times is essentially when the universe was a baby, essentially very young.
Could I ask you to tell me what is the significance of the wind which you detected from this distant galaxy?
Essentially, if these kind of winds from these early galaxies is common among the galaxies which formed in the early universe, then this wind might have bring the products of the formation of the metals, the dust, and the various gas phases which are locked into the central region of galaxy, into the intergalactic medium, the space surrounding these galaxies. And this medium is what later on might have formed other galaxies. So it's important, very important, for what might be the formation of the galaxies that we have in the local universe now.
Do you ever wonder what could have existed beyond the Big Bang?
No. This is a question that no many astronomers or physicists try to tackle, I would say, because essentially you don't have observable quantities which you can measure. And since the work of physicists or astronomers is just to measure quantities and link the various measurements, this is something that goes a little bit beyond the work of a physicist or an astronomer.
Roberto Maiolino's work enables us to observe the early universe shortly after the Big Bang. For me, there's a spiritual dimension in reaching back to the origins of existence. Astrophysics broadens the context in which we live, extends our power to observe and understand, enables us to question ourselves and our place in nature. The evidence of astrophysics shows us that creation is not a one-time event spread out over the 6 days of the Bible. Instead, it's a cosmic process of creation, conservation, destruction, and new creation at a level of magnitude and complexity that defies our understanding.
Oh no. I'm no longer in 1985 or even 1990 or 2003. But where am I? My wireless keyboard is gone. The electric blue sphere seems to have collapsed onto the ground. It seems to have died. I step out of a golden ring of dust, lying in the sand, and here's a clip from the English version of a documentary series on the Sahara, which I also own outright. The series was aired on CBC Radio and National Public Radio.
Ton cœur, et voilà, il y aura toujours, on passe toujours des bons moments, il n'y a pas de problème.
There could be natural explanations for the nighttime sounds that Saharan people think are jinns. The desert is not really empty and still. On the contrary, the Sahara is dynamic. It's constantly on the move, and it's filled with bizarre natural phenomena that give the desert a peculiar voice of its own. John Hare is a modern-day explorer of the Sahara. He was the last recruit into the British colonial administration in northern Nigeria at the southern edge of the Sahara. During his 7 years in Africa, he fell in love with the pace of life here. John Hare has mounted several desert expeditions, riding a species of wild camels he's been lobbying to protect.
There was a terrific bang, and one of our team got a tremendous shock. He thought he'd either set off a landmine or something. And the Tuareg said it's caused by jinns, all these spirits in the desert. I think the real explanation is the sand has formed a dune, but formed it with a sort of hollow in the middle, rather like when you pour something, you know, it's like sand. It'll sort of mound up, but there's a hollow in the middle which the sand hasn't gone into. And then just stepping over it, either with a camel or a person, makes the thing collapse. But what was extraordinary about this was that there was this terrific bang.
The Sahara, stretching from Mauritania northwards to Morocco and eastwards across Algeria all the way to Egypt, is a world of stark contrasts. The desert presents extremes of hot and cold. This harsh environment brings you down to the barest essentials of life and survival. In my tent one evening, I spend an hour watching a black beetle scuttle around a candle I've driven into the sand floor. It wanders off, comes back again, thinks things over, and crisscrosses the sand of my tent, which has formed miniature dunes. I can't help feeling how small we are, lost in the expanse of the desert. This feeling of smallness is something many Saharan travelers would recognize. John Hare.
You feel your utter insignificance. You're just about as significant as one of those tiny grains of sand. And you feel that, you know, flick of a fingers or the onset of a sandstorm, you could be totally obliterated and covered up and nobody would know, and that would be that. But the deserts remain the same. The other wonderful thing is the utter silence, which you can hardly get anywhere in the world now. I'm sure you can in the Arctic and Antarctica. But in the great deserts of the world, you can actually, because there's no bird life, there's nothing. And when the wind drops, there's not even the moaning of the wind. Utter, utter silence. Now, some people would find that very difficult to cope with. I find it wonderful.
Mohammed Ould Aliyin sits under an acacia tree, ready to greet visitors to an archaeological site in the midst of desolate canyons in the Adrar region. A short, old man, dressed in scarf and tunic, he shows me rock paintings of giraffes and lions and stick-like human figures that seem to be dancing. The paintings are actually dabbed on the walls of a rock overhang with a mixture of sheep's blood, fat, and ashes. These paintings go back at least 2,000 and possibly as much as 6,000 years. Nobody knows for sure, since nobody has done carbon-14 dating here yet. The Sahara wasn't always so hot and dry. Given climate change over the millennia, many of the larger animals have disappeared, but the dryness of the climate has also enabled the rock paintings and other vestiges of ancient history to survive, virtually intact, up to our times. The incredibly dry air of the Sahara has also preserved vast private libraries, mostly of Islamic manuscripts, going back many centuries. In her day, Odette du Puigodeau was fascinated to discover the private library of a Muslim holy man, Abdullahi, whose ancient manuscripts formed the basis of a little community of students who had come from all over West Africa.
moment of true harmony. And there, we're back to Montreal. Here we are in 2019. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net. And Evidencia is spelled E-V-I-D-E-N-T-I-A, Evidencia. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2019, George Toombs. All rights reserved. Let's get together soon. Bye for now.